Relatively Geeky presents Doom Speak, the origin of Dr. Doom. This episode is occurring as a result of a confluence of events. Over on Clinton Robinson's Fan Film Fridays podcast, I recently talked about a very good little fan film called Von Doom, the best live-action version of our good doctor I've ever seen. Not kidding. And that film had a nice take on Doom's origins. And on that episode, I referenced the excellent origin that Jack and Stan, mostly Jack in this case, let's be honest, the excellent origin that was presented in FF Annual Number 2. And I reread that terrific story, legitimately. One of my favorite, top five, maybe, comic books of all time. It's terrific. And I reread that for prep for that Fan Film Fridays episode to compare and contrast. And the film, by the way, does a pretty solid job of using parts of that issue, clearly, as a template. So FF Annual 2, primarily the origin story, but that entire issue was fresh on my mind. The second thing was that a bunch of comic types were having a conversation on Twitter as the hashtag Western Comics Month of July was coming to an end. That was, I think, the fourth month that we designated as being dedicated to a specific comics genre. And it was fun enough, and a few of those months had really caught on. So we thought it would be fun to assign other genres to other months. And we did that for like a total of 11 months. And I know what you're thinking at this point of the story. Aren't there 12 months in a year? And yes, there are. And yes, August was empty. And someone, and I honestly don't remember who, put forth the notion that there was one comics creator that could be considered a genre all to himself, and that was the King. And thus, here we sit in August, aka hashtag Jack Kirby Month. And seeing how one of my all-time favorite Doom stories and Doom issues was a Stan and Jack collaboration, this month, this episode, would be the perfect time to cover Fantastic Four Annual Number 2. Except, I had already covered that issue. I have to admit, it was a delightful experience to have done so. Of course, that was 9 years ago when I guested on the Fantasticast, in the days before Relatively Geeky. My Twitter buddy Paul the Book Guy had invited me onto his podcast, and it was as a cast member of the Book Guy show that I had communicated with the Fantastablokes, and had sent Steve and Andy a number of missives regarding their occasional anti-Doom comments. And they were kind enough to invite me onto their show to discuss the epic Fantastic Four Annual 2. Now, enough new people have become podcast listeners in the ensuing 9 years. And even though the old Fantasticast episodes are still out there and available, I don't suspect they're getting a lot of new listens these days, sadly. So I'm saying that it's possible that a good chunk of you listeners have never heard that episode, or have certainly not heard it in many, many years. And well, this is your lucky day. I reached out to Andy Leyland, formerly of the Fantasticast, and currently of Listen to the Prophets, the Palace of Glittering Delights, and the Overlooked Dark Knight. And he said he was fine with me re-releasing that old episode here as a Doomspeak episode. And what is even more perfect is that we will be representing the bulk of that episode, their episode 34, as our episode 34. Come on. How perfect is that? Now, I cut out the bits of their episode that covered another issue, listener feedback, and that sort of stuff. But after this promo, we are all going to jump on the time platform and head all the way back to Fantasticast episode 34, which originally aired March 8th, 2013.
Hey everybody, Clinton Robinson here. I recently attempted to sneak into the Longbox Crusade headquarters basement to watch some of the Albrecht Brothers action movies while the crew was out at the Saturday matinee theater. Too bad I had a little mishap and got stuck down here. With no movies to boot! However, there are pieces of Pat's old podcasting equipment and excellent Wi-Fi service, so I decided to pass the time watching online fan films and talking about them. What, you don't know what a fan film is? Well, there are these non-theatrical movies that people post online of already established characters and settings. Hey, now. Just wait and see. Save all judgment for what happens when you listen to Fan Film Fridays, a new podcast found on the Longbox Crusade podcast feed.
This is an imaginary story, which may never have happened, but then again may have, about a perfect man who came from poverty and did only good. It tells of his origin, when the great battles were yet to begin and the great miracles were yet to happen, of how his enemies conspired against him and of the greatest war between them under the skies of New York, of the people he ruled and the choice he made for them, of how he broke every oath, and finally, how everything he wanted was taken from him. It ends with a smile. It begins in a bustling castle one stormy evening in the turbulent past. Away in the nearby burg, people still glance up fearfully from the streets, glimpsing a distant light on the mountain. But no, it's only a flame, only a torch. This is an imaginary story. Aren't they all?
Everybody, and welcome to an all-new Fantasticast. I am still Andrew Leyland, because Stephen hasn't yet dropped his omnibus on me.
I don't have an omnibus to drop anymore.
Ah, I'm free at last!
Not until the martial law one turns up that I got ordered for under a tenner on Amazon. Yes, hello, I'm Steve Lacey, and I have no omnibus.
And today we are joined by a very, very special guest. Mm-hmm. All the way from the Soviet Republic of Latveria. Is it part of the Soviet Republic?
Doom would not have bowed to Stalin.
We are proud to welcome to the Fantasticast, Professor Allen.
Latveria does not have a lot in common with Switzerland, but neutrality is one thing they have in common.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome
sir.
To the show. Just a quick point of order. Are you happy for us to call you by your first name?
That is perfect.
Fantastic, Professor. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure, Quiz.
Yes, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us. You were one of our earliest letter writers, as it were, although emails in this day and age. And we detected just a gentle pro-Doom bias in those letters.
I like to think of it as a corrective for the mainstream media's negative portrayals of Mr. Doom, Professor Dr. Doom.
The media's negative portrayals. Okay, then. Defend this, Julian McMahon.
Look. Doom had no say in the casting of that pissant movie. Doom would destroy McMahon if he could. The man is scum. I even set Danny Minogue on him, and even she couldn't kill him.
Wow. I mean, if you can take Doom and Galactus and turn them into those two movies, that's not good.
Of course, you are a podcaster as well as an defender of Doom.
Acolyte,
yes.
Yes, after spending years and years and years simply on the listening end of podcasts, I joined the cast of the Book Guys show earlier last year where we talk about books and audiobooks and comic books and occasional podcasts every now and then. It's we do the exact opposite of what a good blog or a good podcast is supposed to do, which is take a very narrow subject, like, say, 1960s Fantastic Four, and cover it to death. We just say, you know, if it's got the word book in it, books on TV, books on film, fiction, nonfiction, books with pictures, books without pictures, podcasts, Doctor Who, we'll talk about them.
Awesome. And it is a great show. It's kind of nice to go into it not really knowing what's going to come up, whereas obviously with a show like this, it doesn't take too much to go, ah, well, they're clearly going to cover these issues. And there's always the odds of having read everything that's covered on the show. They're pretty low.
I'm actually glad that sense comes through, because as a co-host, I have no idea what's coming up either. So I will simply say I love my colleagues and the producers of the Book Guys. But in full disclosure, I did more preparation for this podcast than I have for all of the episodes of that combined. It is off the cuff. Off the top of our heads sometimes, which I think we like to think of it as spontaneity, not lack of preparation.
Yes, absolutely. I have noticed that my level of preparation for this show, as I've got more and more comfortable doing it, has diminished over the last year and a bit.
You mean you still don't do 15 pages of notes?
I might have got them down to, what have I got for today's?
A paragraph.
Before we get into the meat of today's show, because when we reveal what today's show is about, assuming you haven't looked at the title, read the show notes, looked at the picture, or remembered what we said at the end of last week's show, you'll understand why we've got Alan on. But before we do that, we do have some emails to quickly go through. Now, the first one I've got here is from Nicholas Hoekstra. I think that's how I'm pronouncing the surname. It's not one I've come across before. And Nicholas writes, "Hey guys, I just wanted to write and tell you how much I'm enjoying your podcast. I'm only on episode 5, so there are many hours between where I am and where you are currently at. But the fact that you referenced Bubble Bobble in your episode inspired me to write. Classic. I'm visually impaired. Well, we'll cut the politically correct BS and say blind. So podcasts like yours open up the comics in a way I've never been able to experience them. I'm American, but I've worked with good Englishmen for the past 4 years. Your obviously fake accents are fooling no one. But don't you wish Sue would show us her rat love." I'm not quite sure what's meant by that. Her rat love. Her rack, maybe?
Where? I just wish Sue would show us anything.
Oh, she does pretty well in the issue, which I'm not going to spoil today. Anyway, he continues, "Thanks very much, guys. I hope you're keeping it up. Seeing as how there are 28 podcasts before me, it seems that you are. Nick."
Thank you very much, Nick. We appreciate that. I'd never really considered that we may be doing a service to visually impaired people. But we appreciate the compliment. Thank you very much.
We really do, yes. Thank you for taking the time to write in, even though you'll probably listen to this 6 months after we've read it out on the air. Thank you for catching up, and good luck getting the rest of them out of the way.
I wonder where he got that notion of faux accents from. I don't know that any listener
I'm actually from New Zealand.
The gall of accusing you of that.
I'm not even speaking English. It's just all an illusion.
I've got a Babel fish.
It's the Skype universal translator.
That's why it took so long to update today. Andrew, you've got the other email.
I have another email. This one's from Gus Shaw. Hi, Gus. "Hello, Fantasticasters. I just finished episode 30 and have a comment for the Strange Tales story. You were confused when Plant Man sent one plant into Johnny's room to open the bedroom door for another plant with a bucket of water. I have an idea where the bucket-carrying plant came from. It was a house plant in the Storm's home. Plant Man saw the plant through a window, commanded it to fetch a pail of water and meet him at Johnny's room. Then he took an outside plant, had it jimmy the window and opened Johnny's door from the inside. Cheers, Gus." It's certainly as plausible as anything else that's in Strange Tales.
Yes.
Thank you for emailing in. We appreciate you correcting us on that obvious error and your obvious excellent no prize explanation.
In fact, I have a spare no prize here, and I've just put it in the no envelope, attached the no stamp, put a no address on it, and put it into the no post.
Excellent. So that should not arrive in about 3 weeks.
Talking of no prizes, I met someone at the London Super Comic Con who had an actual no prize that he got signed by Stan Lee last year.
What? One of the real envelopes?
He'd been sent one back in, I think, the early 70s.
Brilliant.
And had kept it, and kept it, as you do. And when it came to it, it was like, well, everyone else is taking comics, I'm taking a damn no prize.
Excellent.
Yeah, he was a happy boy. Well, because I did mention it on the last episode, just a very quick thing about the London Super Comic Con. It only take a couple of moments, but just it was a really great show. It was great to meet quite a lot of sort of Fantastic Four people there. George Perez was there, and he remembered me from last year and the sketch that he did for me of The Thing, which I'm sure you've seen and heard me go on and on and on about. I had an amazing encounter with Roy Thomas. Got to sit and chat with Roy Thomas Thomas in the Dime Meets the Convention, just talking about all sorts of things, like him writing in letters to the Fantastic Four, the ones that we've covered on this show, and you know, him being a fan in the early 60s, and a very gentle admission that Strange Tales, whilst a good read at the time, clearly doesn't hold up, which I think is as close I'll ever get to Roy Thomas saying, yeah, it's a bit crap, isn't it? Discussing Kirby Inkers, and just he was a really nice and friendly guy, and that really sort of tickled me. I was after a sketch from Lee Bermejo of The Thing, but he didn't do it because he kept getting distracted, so he didn't get his far down the list. So I'm a bit sad with that. But yeah, it was just a fantastic convention. I'm really glad that I went. And to everyone who listens to the show that I met there, especially, I know that At Fractures are out there and Cooley Bear, really nice to meet you guys. And obviously David Wynn, our previous guest host, was there, as always, and a pleasure to see him. And many other people who I'm sure are sitting there going, he's not mentioned me. I'm going to stick a knife in him when I get to Leeds. So that was London Super Comic Con. So yeah, so having done that, we're going to take a very quick break, play a trailer for whoever show its turn it is to go in there, I've forgotten at this point, and we'll be back to take a look at the life story of Dr. Victor Von Doom.
Hey kids, comics!
Hey Michael!
Yeah?
We need to do a new promo.
A new one?
A new one.
Why?
Because we've moved.
Moved?
Moved! We've moved to a new place. We still read comics.
We do, we still talk about comics.
Because you can't do a comic book podcast unless you read and talk about comics, because that's kind of stupid. But now, we have a new episode still available every Thursday, but at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Hey Kids Comics!
So remember, Hey Kids Comics has moved to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Still, every Thursday. That'll do, won't it?
And we're back to the premiere episode of Doomcast, and I'm your host, Professor Allen. Joining me on this episode are podcasting's Fantastic Two, Steve Lacy and Andy Leyland.
Please, Mr. Doom, we're sorry. Please unchain us. We promise we'll only cover your victories from here on out, because they're all victories. Even when they look like defeats to lesser people, they're actually victories.
There's just been a little too much Reed, a little too much Johnny, a little too much Ben. Not enough Sue, to be fair, in this feed, and I think that's time to change.
There's been a lot too much Johnny.
Not long to go. So let's take a look at this Doctor Doom Annual number one, or known to you Western infidels as Fantastic Four Annual number two.
Western infidels.
this is just another example of Big Comic keeping the hero of the masses down.
Anyway, Alan, please take it away.
We have secrets that have never been revealed before. The fantastic origin of Dr. Doom. Mm-hmm. Earth-shaking scripter, Stan Lee. Breathtaking penciler, Jack Kirby. Epic-making inker, Chickstone, no-faking letterer, Sam Rosen. In the majestic throne room of the Grand Castle of Latveria, Dr. Doom sits on his throne. Despite the overwhelming love his people have for him, and rightly so, considering the prosperity and international acclaim that he has brought their nation, Doom appears distraught, morose. His contemplations are interrupted by an elderly visitor. Doom demands to know who has entered and the old man announces, "It is I, Boris. The time has come, Master." Dr. Doom acknowledges that Boris is right. It is on a night such as this that she would want me to visit. Ooh, mystery and drama. Leading his master with a lantern through the storm-swept landscape, Boris walks down a hill from the Grand Castle, and the pair reach an almost concealed tombstone. As the fury of the storm lashes the barren countryside, Dr. Doom's thoughts drift to the past, and to a band of gypsies who once encamped on that very spot. Werner von Doom was the gypsy band's healer, their medicine man, and he is ordered by a soldier to visit the Baron. Werner says goodbye to his son, Victor, and tells him not to worry. Another gypsy assures both von Dooms that he will watch after little Victor until his father returns. Werner is taken to the castle, to the sick room of the Baroness. Werner von Doom is ordered to heal her with his magic potions. He knows the Baroness cannot survive the night, and that his failure to heal her cost him, as the Baron says,
his own worthless life.
He exits the castle, knowing that he and his son must flee while there is yet time. The wife dies in the night, and the Baron calls out the troops to find the medicine man. While dashing through the forest on a horse, Victor asks why they run instead of standing and fighting. His father comments that he sounds just like his mother. She too feared nothing, no matter how hopeless the odds. At one point, the Von Dooms are bucked off their horse, leaving the father and son team without transportation. As they walk, it starts to rain. Victor tells his father that he's hungry and cold, and the next morning is worse, as somehow the rain has left many inches of snow on the ground. The pair collapse, all hope lost. but a friend of Werner shows up, a younger Boris. Takes Werner and Victor back to camp, but it's clear that Werner is about to die as the trauma of the escape and the harsh conditions have taken their toll. Victor explodes in anger. They murdered my mother when I was but an infant, and now they have slain my father. They'll pay for that. All mankind will pay. Boris thought balloons that young Victor must never learn of his dark sorceress heritage, but Victor immediately finds his mother's potions and strange scientific scrawls. He vows to learn all of her secrets. Over the years, this brilliant son of a gentle, kindly father and a mysterious, enchanted mother grows to manhood with the features of a demigod and the cunning of a demon. His combination of sorcery, scientific genius, and smooth tongue enable him to earn a living as a con artist of sorts. The Latverian authorities even catch up to him once, but the attempt to execute him fails. Hello, Doombot. His daringness and willingness to stand up to the Latverian one percenters make young von Doom a legend among the 99%. The sharing of his wealth with his people aids his popularity, and when the Latverian moves in to quash the uprising, von Doom's badassery makes them pay. A stranger visits the camp, an American who has heard of von Doom's technical wizardry and scientific accomplishments. He is the dean of science at good old State University. Victor accepts the scholarship offer, heartbroken that he has to leave his land and his people. But he promises Boris and the others that he will return someday and reward them for their loyalty. On his first day at State U, von Doom checks out the science lab and meets one Reed Richards. Not to spoil anything, but Reed will eventually become the heroic Dr. Doom's archenemy, the supervillain, Mr. Fantastic. Reed tries to hit on the attractive Latverian, and the American's inappropriate advances are reasonably rebuffed. The creeped-out von Doom would rather live alone than with the unstable American, allowing a large football-playing thing to instead become Reed's roommate. Reed later sneaks into von Doom's private quarters, spying on the work of his superior rival. To gain knowledge of Victor's work with transmutation and dimension warps, Reed makes a few minor adjustments to some of von Doom's equations, causing the Latverian's work to be off by a few decimals. Victor settles himself into an amazing contraption that he designed himself, perhaps with some help from Jack Kirby, in an attempt to contact the Netherworld. His student assistant hesitates, but von Doom quietly informs the young man, in a calm and collected manner, "Silence. Just do as you're told. Throw the switch, please." But Reed's attempted murder of von Doom fails, for although the American did indeed sabotage the experiment, he was too incompetent to even do that effectively. Instead of killing his Latverian rival, he instead leaves the promising young man grossly disfigured. And in what is sadly an all too common circumstance in modern society, the victim of the crime is blamed. And the university expels Victor on the trumped-up charge that Netherworld experiments violate university policy, or some such nonsense. He returns to Latveria by way of Tibet, where he studies the secrets of black magic and sorcery. You know, from Buddhist monks. He learns their magical ways and then forges for himself a suit of armor and a metal face mask. Before it is even cooled, he sets it in place. At this juncture, even the most ardent Doomophiles are willing to admit that this may not have been the best choice. But that Victor von Doom is no more. He has vanished, along with the handsome face he once possessed. The handsome face that attracted a young college boy named Reed Richards. Settling into place a familiar green cloak, he proclaims, "But in this place, there shall be another, wiser, stronger, faster than he was before. More brilliant, more powerful. From this moment on, I shall be known as Dr. Doom." With his super science power still intact, Doom departs Tibet in a flying harness of his own creation. Time passes, during which the mainstream media perpetuates the myth of Dr. Doom as evil genius, a description which is only half correct. Again, another case of Big Comic crushing the hero of the people to perpetuate their own nefarious schemes. All this brings us back to where we started, Doom and his old friend, loyal compatriot Boris, on a hilltop, looking down at the grave of Victor's mother. Victor promises to her that he shall devote his life to the betterment of mankind and peace on Earth, recognizing that the best way for this utopian vision to be accomplished is by taking the reasonable step of, quote, devoting my life to becoming the master of all mankind, unquote. He and Boris return to the castle, past the adoring throng of grateful Latverians, so he can work and plan to bring his wonderful vision to pass, which he would have done many times if it weren't for that meddling Fantastic Four.
Awesome.
That was fantastic.
We might as well give up and go home now.
I was so rapt listening to that. I thought I was listening to a show.
I mean, there was I took some minor liberties with the original text, but I'm not certain. I think there are more ancient manuscripts. It appears that Stan and Jack left a few details out.
Yeah, we may have to examine the text closer in our analysis. And maybe redress the balance, even though it will probably lead to our execution.
That was brilliant. I'm dumbfounded. We're not often speechless on this show.
Page one. Let's take a look at this. Why is Doom's throne emblazoned with the Daredevil logo?
Daredevil stole it from Doom. Doom will find a way to get it back, and he will punish that superhero.
But bearing in mind that Daredevil has yet to go to Latveria, in fact, won't go for quite some time, he couldn't physically have touched it, so how did he see it?
I don't know.
I'm going with time travel.
Time travel, right, okay. Yes, it's a good first shot. Thankfully, his tunic's hanging where it's hanging.
Hello. Yeah, I have to say, I'm a big fan of the Kirby artwork, especially on this opening splash. I'm reading a paperback of Fantastic Four Masterworks Volume 4, and the portion of the drawing that is Doom on the throne has been enlarged to cover the first page.
Ooh.
That's the opening illustration that you see opposite the table of contents. You know, I'm not reading a Doom volume, I'm reading a Fantastic Four volume. But the editors and whoever put the volume together chose that piece as the first piece of art the reader runs into. I think it's a great pose.
It's excellent. It's a very, very good splash page. I've always liked Boris. Boris shows up a couple of times later on down the line, doesn't he?
I think so. Doom would sort of eventually get his own small supporting cast in Latveria. Obviously, most notably, Christoph.
Yes.
But I'm reading the Doom epic that Paul Ryan and Tom DeFalco did in like 93, which also seems to have Skrulls and Lyja and people from alternate universes and future Franklin and evil Nathaniel, just because why have one story when you have 10 going on at the same time? And the characters in that is still popping up after like nearly 20 years. So, I'm sure Boris is so old, he probably popped his clogs before then.
I remember Boris being around somewhere else, but it could be wrong. Yeah, it's an excellent splash page. I always like the idea of Doom just sitting in his chair being all self-pitying.
Mm. Well, he can be quite melodramatic at times.
Only slightly.
Yeah, so this is a melodramatic thing to do. It's sit in the chair, hunched, and listen to some My Chemical Romance, and...
He does get slightly at times.
And then we're into the flashback. At the bottom of page two, unless there's anything to say about the dark and stormy night earlier.
Only the first panel on page two is awesome.
Oh, yes, it is. Some lovely colouring there.
Mm. Doom looking out of the window. So we're looking from outside and the big crooked tree and the light behind him. So he's all in shadow in the window. It's a brilliant flash page, first panel.
In fact, as you said that, these first panels, yes, they feature Doctor Doom. They just don't feel like a Marvel comic, do they?
No, they feel like a Hammer film.
They feel like a Hammer film or a postcode EC.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing.
A DC comic, yeah. Especially the next panel where Boris is carrying his lantern and Doom's wrapped his cloak around himself.
Mm.
It's very... these first four panels off page two are awesome. They're really, really good. I'm very impressed with them. And then you hit with the last panel of the page, which is the flashback. And that's all nice colours. And you can hear the score changing in your head to it from dun dun to I liked it. Thought it was really good. And I've killed the conversation.
The art doesn't necessarily feel, you know, like this era of Marvel, but certainly those text boxes do. Those are Stan at his dramatic best, I think.
They're not obtrusive like some of the text boxes have been. We've had lots and lots of captions. These really do feel like there's a narrator setting the scene, and yeah. This is good.
And obviously, for my synopsis, I borrowed largely from those text boxes for the descriptions.
Mm.
Just to interpret them through Doom's world.
Now, on page three, it's social commentary time.
Oh, yeah.
As we find out that, well, we don't know that he's young Doom at this moment, but the characters there are second-class citizens. They're gypsies.
Now, in the United States, you know, gypsy, that term implies more of almost a lifestyle than ethnic group. So I think this might be less sort of have a different feel in the U.S. than perhaps in Europe, where gypsy just simply implies sort of a nomadic people, almost a romantic sort of what Stan's getting at here, that sort of almost fairy tale land notion of gypsy.
Well, the idea of Gypsy as almost a racial group doesn't really exist anymore, especially in terms of the East European ones, because unfortunately they were a target during the 40s.
Right.
Similar to the Jews, but just not on such a wide scale. But yeah, Stan's sort of using a romantic notion of the Gypsy rather than anything that, I don't know how it is in the States, but certainly travellers and gypsies don't have a particularly good reputation in the UK. Tend to pop up in places, start building things without permission, ruining people's land with troubles and crime that goes along with it. We had a series a couple of years ago called My Big Fat Gypsy Wedding, which just really didn't do anything to show that there was much positive going on there.
Right.
Gosh, this sounds absolutely awful to be saying, but they're not, it's not a culture which is welcomed by most people, certainly in the United Kingdom.
I was curious about that, because that's not the implication that the word has over here, and I'm sure that's not what Stan and Jack were. Well, though early 60s, coming out of World War II, maybe they chose purposely, but it is more almost of a fairy tale, romantic, more nomadic sort of, you can almost choose to be a gypsy, you know, here in the U.S., sort of a hippie type of lifestyle. And obviously with the sort of the medicine man, spiritual healing, there's almost, for us, the equivalent might be Native Americans, which are often portrayed sort of in that, you know, they have, you know, folk magic and folk wisdom and,
yeah,
you know, the sort of the medicine man sort of is sort of an equivalent of that.
Yeah, good point. Obviously, by saying Jack would have identify quite closely with the idea of being from a cultural and racial background that isn't accepted by the majority of the people where you live. It's almost a little pulpish in terms of what they're drawing from that, though, for this story. So they draw the elements that help them convey a story. It is done in broader strokes, although the broad strokes are finer than a lot of comics that you'd see at the time. But it helps them set up the story, and I guess it's almost like a shortcut for the readers to go, oh, yes, they're gypsies. There is that mystical side. There is that distrusted side.
Right, and the fact that there's a sorceress mother and is not, you know, that's sort of part of the, I think that's not as much of a stretch as if you, you know, place this in a different setting.
Yeah, and Andrew, there's nothing to say on this issue.
I have nothing to say on this issue, other than I liked his outfit in panel one. Oh, that was very colourful.
The guy in the purple and the yellow?
No, yeah, that would be, he's in blue and red in my copy.
What, on panel one and page three?
Yeah.
The guy who goes, silence, you were to come with me by order of the Baron.
Yeah, he's wearing a nice blue tunic with a red belt, a blue cape,
wow,
red pants, with black boots and a nice natty blue hat with a red feather sticking from it. And right, he's got a monocle and a lovely tash.
Maybe Andrew has a different word for purple, but I'm looking at what I would call purple.
Yeah, Andrew, what are you reading from today?
I've got a digital copy today. And he's wearing blue.
I suspect you've got a digital copy from one of the recolored ones. Have you got your omnibus nearby?
No, it's upstairs.
Ah, because obviously the digital copy I've got is the scan of the original comic on the DVD. And we do know that at times they have recolored. So we have had, I think, the original Masterworks, because Alan, you're reading from more recent Masterworks. Am I right in suggesting that?
Yes.
Yeah. The original Masterworks, they did recolor and it didn't go down so well. So I suspect you're looking at one of those rather than the original, because purple and yellow with brown boots is all we've got.
This guy looks like he's modeled his outfit on Superman.
I like a few panels down. I like I like young Victor's. We've got his in a yellow shirt and a red vest.
See, in mine, he's wearing a green vest.
but the guy behind him is wearing green and purple.
No, he's wearing purple and yellow.
Ay, caramba. Wow.
This is awesome. It's like an alternate reality version. You wear the colors off on your TV.
You've got the ultimate of ultimate universe version of this story.
I would not sully my hands with the ultimate version of this story.
Mainly because they haven't written it.
And then on the next page, I love how the rainstorm leaves that much snow on the ground. I'm not sure that's the way it works in the hey, but that's not the way precipitation works on this side of the Atlantic.
I suppose you could say it was sleety a bit, and then it turned into snow, possibly. My man in the nice natty outfit is still wearing blue and red. Although, ooh, look, shiny.
Bear in mind all the retcons since now. Could we not argue that the High Evolutionary had something to do with this? Actually, let's not bring him into it.
No, we'll ignore him. I liked this page. I like this page a lot. I thought the art on this page is exceptional. Mm. I like that Werner von Doom wraps all his clothes around his son to save his son's life.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a lovely little touch.
I love the frantic action of the soldiers ripping the gypsy camp apart in the first panel.
Mm-hmm.
And because the way the page is laid out, which is one long panel at the top with six smaller panels underneath, your eye's really drawn to it.
Pulling things down, knocking down houses. And
yeah.
Wagons.
Just ripping the whole place to pieces whilst these sort of poor gypsy women look on going, oh no, please don't do this to us. But in more gypsy sounding voices.
But in our different versions of the comic, the voices would be different.
Yes. It turns out the gypsies are Welsh. In your copy.
Come on, boyo. You will tell us where they are.
Oh, Jones Andrew. No. So close and yet. You just
I'm sorry, it wasn't even close.
Well, I wouldn't know.
See, there you go. I would have got away with it if you hadn't said anything.
I do like on page 5 that Doom's mother was so keen to hide that she was a witch that she just gently buried her stuff in a chest that doesn't even look like it's attempted to be disguised. And she's not even, you know, left it somewhere else. It's in the house or the caravan or whatever they're in.
Yeah, the word secrets might not actually technically apply.
Yes.
And it's a nice chest, though.
It is. It is.
Hello.
Doom says, that name, can it be it belongs to my mother? But we don't get her, his mother named here. But I'm trying to remember what his mother's name is. And it's important and relevant. I can't think what it is. Anyone?
I can't remember what his mum's name is.
No.
If only at our fingertips we had a research...
Dr. Doom. Into Wikipedia. Let's see what we got.
Dr. Doom's mum.
Well, it'll say was born to so-and-so and so-and-so.
Cynthia von Doom.
Cynthia. Okay. That wasn't what I was expecting.
I wasn't expecting Cynthia von Doom. No.
Well, I think to my name's Cynthia. I'm his mother.
You all right, Werner? You want to come into my tavern, Werner?
You want a cup of tea, Werner? Got a nice biscuit?
Now you sound like Terry Jones.
He's not von Doom. He's a very naughty boy.
Or it would just be spam, 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 cup of tea, biscuit and spam. I don't like spam!
Poor Victor. Fancy having Terry Jones as your mum.
Anyway, so Cynthia, which was surprising to us.
Yes. Werner, Victor and
Cynthia
von Doom.
Yes, back to the comic. Doom trains himself in mystical ways.
I like his hat.
His hat in the bottom of panel 5 is a very undoom-like hat.
It is, isn't it? But he's very undoom-like here. He's all very shiny and he smiles a lot and he's a good-looking bloke and he's a bit of a trickster.
Yes, him on the horse with the hat and the feather poking out of it.
That looks somewhat Royal Canadian Mounted Police is maybe the closest thing I can come to.
I'll go with that. Andrew, you've probably got a pink tunic there, so not.
No, he's got a green tunic.
Oh,
no.
It's red for us.
It's red.
Doom does not wear pink.
Actually, we've never seen his underwear, but anyway.
Victoria's Secret.
Commando.
And then he...
Which is quite cold in that armour.
Yeah, so I was just looking at the next page. So, like all true untrustworthy gypsies, it turns out he's gamming them all, isn't he?
Yeah.
So it turns out this is playing into a stereotype, huh?
Probably, yeah.
I do like the first appearance of the Doombot in the bottom of page 6.
Yeah, I like that his face has just fallen off.
I didn't say it was a great Doombot.
Well, it's a prototype Doombot.
Yes.
0.1.
But...
Yeah, Doom 3.1. Doom 98's just around the corner.
One thing that's not explained, because they go into this of how he's got his sorceress powers, doesn't mention where he got all his advanced robotics and electrical engineering from.
If Tony Stark can build his Iron Man armor in a cave in the middle of Iraq.
Yes, but he comes from he's well educated and things like that. Doom was raised in a caravan. He was raised with the people that he has scammed, and they haven't got a clue what's going on. So, and it's before he goes to university. So, at what point does he gain all this knowledge and can, you know, make an early Doombot?
I got the same note, really. Where did he get all the materials to build all this stuff?
Doombot
he's smart enough to do it. Maybe he gets them from mail order. I don't know.
He does comment that when he finds the magic potions, he refers to them also as strange scientific secrets. So there's some weird attempt to blend, I guess, the magic and the scientific. But again, the issue of the resources and the training. Let's just say that happened between panels.
The There was a lot of stuff happening between panels in this story.
Well, so much that Ed Brubaker did do an entire six-issue mini Books of Doom on this. And, of course, they wanted to do, a couple of years ago, an ongoing about Young Doom or a mini-series, but that was suddenly pulled at the last minute. That was going to have Becky Cloonan art. I was looking forward to that. You then get the great scene at the top of page 7 where a tank fires on a gypsy wagon and doesn't destroy it, and Doom... because he's treated with the compound that makes him impervious to explosive gunfire. Has he been taking lessons from Diablo? Props to the guy for being very clever. But again, how is he able to create a freeze grenade?
Sorcery and magic scientific secrets. Thank you.
Those accursed magic scientific secrets. How did the dean of the state university just find them?
Convenience.
YouTube? Yeah, okay, fair enough. If they're traveling pack of gypsies, how did he happen upon them?
Yeah, and is this really how... Because I'm sure college applications, Professor Allen, you are obviously in the education system, I'm sure they're a bit more challenging to get into than the dean just happens to come across and go, oh, go on, come to my uni.
Oh, no, we'll take anyone now.
I will say the next few pages of them at college, there are a few factual shortcuts taken.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like the fact that, I mean, as creative as this story has been so far, the fact that he's the dean of science at State University, not even Empire State, Manhattan State, it's not Kirby State, Marvel State, it's just State. That would be like come to university. Generic, it's generic State University.
Come to education!
And he gets on a plane before the day's ended. Wow. So the guy shakes his hand and says, right, come with us now. And he does. He just leaves.
And I don't know, but in the United States, the university actually assigns freshman roommates. It's not a free-for-all, pick-your-own situation.
I mean, I guess most students aren't personally recruited by the dean either. But yeah, I can imagine he's got preferential treatment. In fact, I'm just bringing up what we're seeing over the next few pages, well, from here until the end of the story, is an expansion of 6 panels from Doom's first appearance, where Doom is at university, the explosion, the scarring, and going to find out about black magic and sorcery. And there's been a lot of expansion of this over the years, of this time that Reed and Doom spent at uni, or at college, as I should say. God, Reed's introduction makes you want to punch him. Well, it looks like someone else is as anxious to see the science lab as I am. The name's Richards, fella. Reed's Richards.
That is no concern of mine.
Yeah, perfect. It's like anyone who introduces him like that can frankly bugger off.
Well, it does. You get the next couple of panels, Reed is hounding him. Mm. And Doom is obviously just trying to like get away from him at every available opportunity. And Reed doesn't leave him alone. I'd have told him to piss off as well.
Finally, you're coming around to the appropriate way of thinking. How many episodes have you guys tried to make Reed Richards into a hero?
Another 700 odd to go. And then we see the first meeting between Ben and Reed. Which, did they meet? Is this the second time we've seen this for you and me, Andy, because of the thing too? Or were they already friends in that when we got flashbacks?
I think we got flashbacks to them becoming roommates.
Mm.
If memory serves.
Yes, we do see their initial meeting. So yeah, so for most people reading through, this is the first time they've met. But because we took a jump in time through Doom's time platform using the power of Kang, Immortus and Ramatut, we've done it out of order.
Never mind.
Ah, well. And we see Doom in his fetching red jumper.
Brown.
Of course.
That could just be shading then.
Yeah.
Is Reed wearing yellow?
On which page?
On the same page.
Page 8.
Page 9.
Oh, we've turned over a page. Reed's not wearing yellow, no. He's wearing a natty white shirt and blue pant combo in panel 2. And then later on down there, he's wearing a nice light brown jumper with jeans, by the looks of things.
Oh, see, we've got slacks and a yellow jumper. The Kirby tech at the bottom of page 9 does look a little bit like an electric chair. Which I guess is appropriate considering what happens to him.
It's the Aurora chair.
It is a chair and it is electric, so.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that.
That lever between the legs looks suspicious. If you look, there's a lever attached to where your legs would sit over the edge of the chair, and it's right in the middle, so it's going to sit between your legs.
Yeah, because he uses it on the next perch. It doesn't look like it comes all the way back and, you know, would do him some damage.
But, you know, surely you just from a perception point of view, put that somewhere else.
Yeah, unless you had an old chopper bicycle when you were a kid where the gear stick was between your legs.
Ooh, really?
Oh, yes.
Alan's going, chopper? What's that? Who is it who's helping Doom? the blonde guy at the bottom of page 9, who he is.
It just says miscellaneous he's assistant. Him. Yeah, miscellaneous and lab assistant.
He does say if the faculty staff learns I'm helping you, I'm in trouble, and then everything blows up. And there's that little caption: the helper miraculously escaped. No, he didn't. The helper was burned to a crisp.
Yeah.
Judging by the size of that explosion.
And thus Doom is scarred.
Because Reed altered his equations.
That's the only thing that makes sense.
It is, yeah. I refuse to believe that Doom's equations were off by a few decimals.
Did the dean come to personally recruit Reed? I don't think so.
Hold on. Reed, in this version, Reed didn't do anything. He just says, hey, you should check them. But doesn't say I've changed them.
No, Reed doesn't change anything. But that's the only explanation that makes sense. Doom can't be wrong.
After Richards breaks in to Doom's private, I don't want to call it a lair, but a private dorm room, suspiciously looks over his equations. I mean, look, you guys, you can choose to believe what you want to believe.
In that panel, though, going back to the bus for page 9, was Reed in the same room where the big electromagnetic aurora chair is?
No,
I think we've had a change of location.
Yeah.
Because Doom's still holding the notes in his hand and closing the door.
Oh.
Implying that Reed has just walked out of that very door.
Good point.
But the art makes it look like we're in a completely different location. If we're not in a completely different location, if I was Reed, surely your attention would have been attracted by the huge church
that's in his dorm room.
Just off to the side and not the bits of paper.
I was just thinking, we're talking about who alters what. In Ultimate Fantastic Four, it's Doom altering Reed's equations that is their first encounter, and Doom gets it right and allows Reed to break through to the end zone. But it's Ultimate Fantastic Four, so if it's not written by Warren Ellis, I don't care. Which is a good rule of thumb generally with comics, but this is probably the bit of Doom's origin that I guess has the least resonance across the years, because the rivalry between the two and the accident, the loss of his mother driving him forward, but the, you know, those things are always there. But, you know, climbing the mountains in Tibet to get some monks to forge his armor just seemed, that bit always feels a little, that's a bit too crazy.
Yeah, I'm not totally familiar with my Eastern and Central European geography. I'm not sure that's on the way. I think you have to go a little out of the way.
Yeah, but more the thing of the idea that he didn't craft it himself for a start.
Mm-hmm.
He's got other people to do it. The idea that hasn't gone to Latveria for this. I don't know. It feels a little off to me. Not in a bad way, but just in that it doesn't hold up as well and doesn't have that resonance across the years that the rivalry, that the experiment, that his mother does.
Yeah, we said a few pages back that it certainly appeared if he's making some of the things that he made in Latveria with the chemically treated wagons and mechanical men, that he could have gotten to make the armor by himself. Again, I think they're probably going again for that Tibet as the land of mystery.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, again, sort of that romantic notion.
Love the furnace at the bottom of page 10. Massive, great big Buddha head.
I suppose it also depends which version of the story you believe, Stan or Jax. Jack always had this idea that he only had a tiny little scar on his face. And Stan always believed that he was really disfigured. And then when they retold this in the 80s, they had it that he did have a tiny little scar on his face. And it's putting the mask on that disfigures his face to try and tie the two different versions together. Seems a bit silly to me if he's only got a little scar on his face, why he would then deliberately put on a metal plate that he's still burning.
Yeah.
Has he not heard of plastic surgery?
I love that he does put this thing on. He's so dedicated. It's not cool yet. It doesn't matter. He presses it. It's quite a disturbing and horrific image that he's done that to himself. It's handled very, very tastefully, presumably for code reasons.
It's almost as if he doesn't have the patience.
Mm.
He needs to make the transition now, even if waiting 60 seconds, 120 seconds would be a wiser move.
Yeah. And I guess it's almost like he fuses his face to the mask. Gives himself over completely. I mean, obviously he doesn't, because he removes it many times since. But, you know, you're pushing hot metal into your face. That's going to kind of stick.
We've never seen this special ring that enables him to remove his mask before. And
yeah.
I don't recall us seeing it again after this annual.
This is like Johnny's decoder ring from the last issue, isn't it?
We'll never see it again.
Yeah.
I don't recall him needing the ring to undo the mask again. But
then we have never seen someone else try to remove his mask yet. And I don't think we will do. It's not one of those events that's really stood out. But yeah, every time he's demasked, it's been at his own behest.
Yeah, so I suppose it doesn't really matter. We don't see it, just that we know it's there.
The nuclear-powered flying harness that he created in a monastery at the top of a mountain in Tibet.
Take that, Tony Stark. I will take your cave, and I will raise you Tibetan monastery.
Awesome. Yeah, so where did you get that plutonium from? Oh, they just had it lying around, did they? And it was fully activated as a nuclear material. Right, okay. Tony Stark, he's got the repulse technology. He's able to fly away from his cave once he's destroyed all the bad guys. Doom just doesn't have the patience to climb down the mountain. I notice there's no Daily Bugle on page 12. We've got a news record, Daily Telegraph, the Post, the Evening something, but no Daily Bugle. I guess Jonah, heroes need vilifying, not villains.
Evil genius is at best only half correct. You can decide which half.
And that middle panel on page 12, it has got to be one of the most important panels in Doctor Doom, because that panel encapsulates everything that would be his relationship with the people of Latveria. And they're still riffing off of that today. This pseudo Stockholm Syndrome-esque love that his people have for him, despite the fact that he's an utter shit.
The land has been prosperous since he ruled.
They call him master, but that's okay.
And hush, dear, you must be silent when the master passes. There's some bowings, removing of hats.
Scraping, yeah. It's all...
It's a powerful shot.
The last panel of page 12, Doom's nuclear-propelled jetpack explodes.
Killing everyone in the castle.
Yeah, there is this. It's supposed to be a sort of big dramatic shot of the castle to end the story on, but the colouring does make it look like there's a massive explosion happening inside it. And thus endeth the origin of Doom. So, what do we think of that?
I thought it was awesome. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I thought it was great. The only issue with the writing, as important as the mother is, both in the story and in the legacy of this, and I'm not sure that was paid off as well. I mean, the framing sequence is sort of mother focused, but the flashback, as you guys said, features his dad in some really sort of heroic father moments. And I know the mother takes the center stage from here on out, but I don't know if he had been looking down maybe at two tombstones and sort of giving equal weight to both his parents. I thought, at least in this story, the mother part was not really paid off. Again, it was really more a father story in the flashback, but that's a minor quibble.
I really liked it. It's a common trick, especially if your name's Geoff Johns, to take a villain who has previously worked on really only one level and provide a backstory that deepens who the character is and how you as a reader relate to him. It has been overplayed a little too much by Johns, but when you first read that issue of Flash where he took Captain Cold and took him from a perfectly acceptable B-level villain and just turned him into this amazing character that you completely understood everything about him and why he was conflicting, the tragedies that made him. That's what happens here. Doctor Doom, prior to now, apologies Alan, he's been an awesome foe for the team, but he's very much been a I will defeat the four because I am it's all been quite one note. And now to understand what caused him to create the experiment that caused his accident and the tragedy of his history, you still don't like him very much because he is a villain, but you feel for him more, and you the understanding of why he's doing what he's doing is so much stronger. And as far as origins go, this is the true origin for Doom, and people have added to it across the years, but no one's ever sort of gone, right, well, out with this, we'll have him start again with something else.
And then as you said, this sort of story has become a trend, almost a trope.
Yeah,
but not in 1964.
No, no one was revisiting their origins back in 1964. You have a look at someone like, not that I've read many DC stories from the time, but if you ever read the first appearance of Black Hand, and Black Hand we all know now is this sort of zombie necrophiliac, the causer of Blackest Night and the Dead for Rising. In his original appearance, he was a guy who went, "Oh, I really like criminals. I'm going to make notes on how to be a criminal. When I'm in a situation, I'll refer to my notes, and thus I'll be able to defeat anything." That was who Black Hand was, and even though it was crap, they stuck with that for so long. you know, frankly, becoming a zombie necrophiliac was the best thing that ever happened to him.
Yeah, that was a step up.
But you start with a villain, and they're lumbered with their origin, no matter how bad it is. And when you only have to create a hero origin once, because you've got your character. Spider-Man only needs that one origin because you're writing a book ongoing. You don't need to come up with a new origin every issue. But when you've got to introduce 20 villains in 30 issues, you need 20 separate origins. Not all of them are going to be fantastic.
And there are, you know, as original as some of these are, you know, Stan certainly, there's somewhat of a theme. Obviously, the Namor parallels to Doctor Doom are pretty clear, Stan seemed to like this notion of sort of the villain as ruler of a land,
but also outcast at the same time.
Yeah, the outcast. If you want to throw in even though not a villain, there's the Wakanda aspect of this, and he likes this idea of the ruler of the land being a hero or villain or something like that. And it's, gone back to, but obviously, Namor and Doom have been characterized quite differently, but there is that sort of that nugget in common.
I think we liked that.
Yes, it was very good.
On the very next page, we start the pinup pages, which for the first set, they're the villains that have appeared since the last annual. So we got a pinup page for the Super Skrull and a little shot of him in action. We've got Ramatut, who's sitting on his throne holding a gun, and he is the Pharaoh from the future. And it's not the last time we're going to see him this issue. We've got the Molecule Man, who... Anyway.
Yeah.
The Hate Monger? I almost forgotten he was in it. And that great picture of, they've got it wrong slightly. They've got that great thing of where Reed pretended to be a road to upset the soldiers that the Hate Monger had, except in this one, it's the Hate Monger himself walking down the road. Of course, as we can't forget, the Hate Monger was Hitler! We've got the Infant Terrible. And then Diablo. And that rounds off the villain pinups.
I must say, looking at this, I was thinking, it did take me a second to click as you pointed out. I'm thinking, why did they pick these villains? I mean, these are not the high end. It's the ones that have appeared since annual one. Okay, gotcha. That's why it took me a second to compute that.
If you take that period of time, it's weird, isn't it? Other than the Super Skrull, none of these really stand up as epic, important Fantastic Four villains. Ramatut is better known as Kang, who's an Avengers villain. The Molecule Man, yes. The Hate Monger was cloned and came back as a Captain America villain. The Infant Terrible really didn't have much of a history, and Diablo isn't that great as a villain. Whereas over in Strange Tales, you've got people who've made far more appearances. The Plant Man, the Pastebot Pete, the Wizard. It seems like without realizing it at the time, the creativity with the villains was happening in the second title.
Interesting. Well, one of the things I like about the Marvel universe is I don't mind the idea of sharing villains. And if they're sort of supposed to take place in the same world and in some cases the same city, that's not a stretch for me. Matter of fact, one of my earliest probably exposures to Doctor Doom is a terrific two-part Iron Man story from the early 80s. And Iron Man and Doom, obviously, we've sort of joked about it a little bit, but they have enough in common that they can go toe-to-toe. That idea of sharing villains does not bother me, and those lines are not nearly as those are in the DC world, those lines are drawn much more clearly.
And then we've got the reprint of Fantastic Four number 5. I didn't even need to open up the comic, did I? I could just flick forward. And it's basically a straight reprint to show the team's first battle with Doctor Doom. So it is interspersed, however. After page 9 of that story, we've then got a pin-up of Johnny flying around, whilst I assume that's Dory in the car in the background. We've got a pin-up of Sue looking like she's about to fall over backwards.
But she has definitely 1960s hair.
She does. And to be honest, I don't think she looks attractive in the slightest here. It would have been much nicer. I don't think he was working for them at the time, but if they'd have got Jazzy John Romita to draw this, it would have been a bit of a knockout. When Kirby tries to pose someone to look attractive,
it
doesn't work as well. More reprint. After page 17 of the reprint, we've got my favourite pinup of the whole thing, which is Ben with an Acme mind detector scanning a package from the Yancey Street gang.
And he has some weird Kirby tech in his room too, it looks like.
Yeah,
over his shoulder.
Like he's got Thunderbird 5 hanging from his ceiling. Alicia gets a pinup before we get a pinup from Reed, and she sculpted.
Yeah, and in her background, she has her, what a, I guess, are her artistic models, but appears, I don't know, perhaps those are former lovers who've hanged themselves. Mm. I can't quite tell what that is.
Yes. Oh, God. That would be creepy. That would be a villain. And then just after the end of Fantastic Four number 5, we've got Reed with the biggest piece of Kirby tech going. And the caption says, "Just between us, I don't know what this silly contraption is either. Keep smiling, Reed."
Why did he build it then?
Why not? It's a glorious piece of equipment, because Kirby's not constrained by having to do multiple panels on a page. He's just gone to town on this, and it's glorious.
I'm a big fan of Jack, and I think that's a beautiful splash page. Like you said, that is one impressive piece of something.
Yeah.
Right, that brings us to the end of our first part of this coverage. So we're going to take a very quick break. We're going to play a trailer for someone's show. I won't spoil anything, but it might just be someone who's not been on this show before but is currently guest hosting. Wah. And then we'll be back to take a look at the final victory of Doctor Doom.
Hi, this is Professor Allen, and when I'm not listening to an awesome podcast like this one, I'm co-hosting an awesome podcast, The Book Guy Show. Every week we cover book news, book reviews, comic books, audiobooks, audio dramas, and podcasts. Search for The Book Guys Show on iTunes or come visit us at bookguys.ca.
Okay, we're back. Before we jump into the second half of this annual, we're actually going to jump back out of the annual and take a look at the cover, because we kind of forgot to do that. So, this is a typical Marvel early 60s annual cover, which is lots and lots of text on there. The letters in the title, Fantastic Four, are different colours to help it stand out. We get the 72 big pages annual banner above the title. We've got a rosette on it saying the world's greatest annual. We've got a caption box saying, featuring a double-length epic, the final victory of Doctor Doom, and a big purple splodgy thing in the bottom saying, "Seeing all its pulse-pounding suspense, the never-before-revealed origin of Doctor Doom." And somehow on that, they've managed to fit in a picture of a giant Doctor Doom fighting the Fantastic Four.
I like it, because the way that Reed is stretched and hang out almost look like he's on, you know, puppet. There's a sort of puppet, you know, aspect to that almost.
Well, Doom's playing a very wrong version of Cat's Cradle. I do have to ask, what's with the white lines all over Reed's costume? I guess they're supposed to be like light
shading,
points.
A light of something, yeah.
But especially the one across the arm that looks like it's sort of spiraling around slightly. I guess that didn't go so well.
And as a professor of business and finance, I do have to point out that 25 cents in 1964 would be a little under $2 today, or about a buck and a quarter, or a pound and a quarter, 1.5 euros. So this 72 pages is quite a bargain.
Wow. Andrew, any thoughts on the cover?
I like the white backgrounds. I always think they stand out quite well. I'm always a bit dubious where they have big looming Doctor Dooms and tiny Fantastic Fours, because I'm always thinking, what, has he just took like Giant Man's potion or something? And I like that Sue's hanging from his thumb, but still manages to pose like a supermodel.
Yes. In fact, just thinking about it. Let's take a look at the cover. Yeah, this is kind of similar to the cover of Fantastic Four number 16, which had a giant Doom with the Fantastic Four clasped in his hand. There's no Ant-Man, thankfully. But yeah, it's a similar concept. Although I think the execution here, with things like the way Reed is posed, just works a lot better. Right, let's get into this. So after all of these pin-ups and reprints, it's time to get back to some original material. As the giant arrow points out, these are all new thrills. The fabulous Fantastic Four fall victims of the final victory of Doctor Doom. Shouldn't that read fall victims to the final victory of Doctor Doom? Anyway, it's a Stan Lee story spectacular, a Jack Kirby illustrative idyll, a Chick Stone delineation delight, and a Sam Rosen lettering landmark. And more importantly, it's a rare Sam Rosen, not S. Rosen credit. Well, rare for this time at least. We open our story with the four plummeting into their deaths in the skies above New York. We then close our story 2 pounds later with a giant splat. Anyway, Amazing Spider-Man annual, Andy.
Are we doing that first?
No, I'm just saying, because we've ended this. Never mind. Have some more Irish lilt.
Okay.
Ben has forgotten to rebore the exhaust on the Fantastica. As Ben struggles to land the flying tub, Johnny tries to clear space on the road. It almost works, although Ben manages to bump an antique car, angering the owner. Repair efforts only damage the car more, much like that episode of Father Ted with the raffle. And a passing art dealer, though, offers to buy the car for lots of money, and Ben decides to help out by trashing more cars for cash. Reed then fixes the Fantastica, and the team take off. Meanwhile, out in space, a strange spaceship comes across the body of Dr. Doom, transported into space by what I can only describe as a crack in space and time at the end of Fantastic Four number 25. The spaceship brings him aboard just before the air in his armour runs out. We discover that the pilot of the ship is none other than Rama Tut. The two villains swap, being beaten by the Fantastic Four stories, before coming to the realisation that, quite literally through wibbly-wobbly timey-wimeyness, they are most likely the same person at different points in their lives. Rama Tut suggests a team-up, but Doom fears that should either one of them die, a paradox will occur. Rama Tut then provides Doom with a spaceship for him to return to Earth, before heading off to become Kang in this month's Avengers. Doom parachutes from the craft into New York under the cover of darkness. He then makes his way to the Latverian embassy, where he gives instruction to his staff there and drinks a toast to his future success. I think that's as good a point as any to take a break and take a look at the pages in detail. So, page one.
Well, that's a good splash page.
It is, isn't it? Fire.
I like the fact that the Fantastic Car has car trouble. That just amused me for some reason.
Yeah, he's forgotten to clean out the exhaust.
Often in a shot like this, you've got the thing at the front and then the rest of the team at the back. You can get some wonky perspective, but I think this is pretty pretty solid, actually. Even Reed's stretching into the foreground does not look awkward.
Yeah, I love Johnny grasping onto the his
holding
pot.
On for dear life.
Yeah,
it's almost as if he can't fly.
And then we get this great comedy scene where Ben bumps the antique car. The guy's ranting and raves, so Ben tries and fix it, makes it even worse. Then the art dealer shows up, offers loads of money, so Ben decides to go and beat up another one.
Yeah, there's a lot of property damage in this one.
It's crazy and silly and funny. I love it.
And yet, despite the clear evidence portrayed on this page, Big Comic is still willing to portray these menaces to private property as heroes.
I love the bashful thing at the top of page three when he looks ashamed of what he's done. He's hiding his face behind his hand.
It's his eyes that sell that panel.
Yeah.
His eyes just look really, I'm sorry. No, no. And it's set off by the last panel on the same page as well, where the thing's just like, oh, like he's just had enough and he's got his hands clutched to his head.
I don't have much else to say for this scene. Unless anyone else has?
No, no, no.
Cool, let's go into space. This whole thing with Doom and Rama Tut.
Did you not think this caused more questions than it answered?
Yeah, when we met Rama Tut back in, was it 18 or 19? He hinted that his descendant was Doctor Doom. And then this scene suggests that, no, they're the same person, which isn't something which is run with. The general thing is, yeah, he's a descendant of Doctor Doom, and then Rama Tut goes and becomes Kang, then becomes Immortus, and then who knows where it stands now. But yeah, it was interesting. The idea that they're dealing with paradoxes and, you know, these recursive time things. I just want to say wibbly-wobbliness, because what it is... As far as Get Outs go, but the last time we saw Doom, he was being transported into space.
Yeah.
And he could be anywhere. So it is fairly coincidental, but I quite like that the Get Out, they didn't just go, oh, a passing spaceship picked up. It was a passing spaceship piloted by someone, his descendant from the future, who might also be himself. You know, if you're going to layer on the coincidence, you might as well do it really thick.
Yeah, if you're going to mess around with time travel, you may as well do it properly. But I just ended up getting to the end of that scene and thinking, it exists purely to show how Doctor Doom was saved. So just show how he got saved and moved on. Because the time travel stuff, I ended up just sat there going, wait, no, hang about, hold on. And then I just gave up trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I didn't see how they came to the conclusion that they might be the same person. I know time is strange that way, but I mean, again, I like the idea of addressing the potential paradox, but this particular solution, not sure about.
And what Doom says, or perhaps during one of your trips to the past, you became the gypsy, you became Dr. Doom. We've just seen him as a kid.
Yeah, and he can't be Doom from the future unless he's got his face fixed at some point.
And wouldn't he have remembered having been a child now that...
Yeah.
This is what I mean. I did
and
sit
also,
there.
If that's the case, then that invalidates his entire origin. I've done everything because of my mother. Actually, it turns out she wasn't my mother at all. She was 500 years too early.
Yeah. I did sit down and try and work it all out with graphs and flowcharts, and I gave up and read the rest of the comic.
Yeah, but the moment you're trying to work out anything involving Ramatut, Kang, or Immortus, if you're not referring to Avengers, what was it?
Oh, the Kurt Busiek one.
Yeah.
Avengers Forever?
Avengers Forever. If you're not referring to that, and I get very lost in that, you're just on a losing battle.
So moving on to the Fantastic Four, then.
Yes. Love that sort of half-page panel on page 6. That's lovely. Doom and Ramatut and the Kirby Tech.
Yeah, I like the Kirby Tech on that page.
And the Kirby, I think Chick Stone is an excellent Kirby Tech inker. Because much like we said, his faces look more like Kirby than anything we've seen before. His Kirby Tech is unrivaled with anything we've seen so far.
He's very good. I mean, we're looking forward to Joe Sinner, but I think we'll miss Chick Stone.
We will do.
Yeah, what I like about this piece is, I mean, sometimes the Kirby work in general can be sort of blocky, you know, almost. But this has angles and curves and shapes, and it's again, another tour de force effort of Kirby Tech.
And then he's gone back to Earth. And there's a wonderful moment on page 7 where they see a shooting star, or Sue thinks a shooting star. No, it's Doom come to destroy you all. Oh, the irony.
I like that Reed's, I'd guess that it's a man-made capsule instead, but then doesn't bother going investigating it.
Yes, I'll just search for Doom instead. Oh, if only you'd have gone there.
Yeah, if only you'd have gone and investigated that would have solved all your problems.
On the bottom of page 7, a somewhat different reaction to Doom walking through the center of New York than he gets walking through Latveria.
Yeah, that's a nice mirror of that, because he's walking at the same angle but in the other direction.
The other direction, and the reactions are more not quite as reverential, shall we say?
Yes, but Doom forgives them their trespasses, and then we get the Latverian embassy for the first time, a building that would have quite a role to play over the years, because it gives Doom a nice little base within New York City for him to plot and work from. And it does set the idea, which we haven't really seen before. If he can just walk into the embassy unmolested, basically he's a guy with diplomatic immunity.
Yes, he is. Something that would be emphasized in the second Superman Spider-Man team up, the fact that Doom has diplomatic immunity so Superman can't touch him.
Yeah, and that time when he savagely beat Robin to death with a crowbar before blowing up the wait. But yeah, a villain with diplomatic immunity that you know is an utter shit and you can't do anything about it is such a great thing to do. You know, whilst it's a bit crazy that effectively Al-Qaeda gave the Joker diplomatic immunity in the late 80s, it didn't half make him a slippery git.
I don't know if you guys are watching or have watched the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon, but there have been at least two episodes with Dr. Doom, one featuring the Latverian embassy in New York. Very funny, very good adventure. That one features Captain America as well, but Doom in a comedy, that's always a good thing to see, right?
Soon, Reed's adhesive tests are interrupted by the arrival of an invitation for the team to attend a function at the Latverian embassy, where they are to be awarded a scientific fellowship, because embassies do that all the time. The team duly attend a banquet where the cream of New York and Latverian society are present. Reed has a random suspicion and is the only member of the team not to drink the special drinks. The party continues as Doom observes, confident of his eventual success. Ben riles Johnny, but when Johnny goes to fight him a short while later, Ben has no knowledge of the slight. But the two fight anyway. Meanwhile, Sue stumbles across Reed making out with a Latverian socialite, and she gets dumped by him. Heading out into the corridor, she runs into the rest of the four, and they all fight, destroying priceless Latverian artifacts in the process. Johnny and Ben fight their way literally out of the embassy, whilst Reed tries to explain that he's worked everything out, but eventual Sue uses her shields to take him down. As this is happening, Emo Doom removes his mask, poses melodramatically, and destroys mirrors. The breaking glass alerts Reed and Sue, who abandon their fight to respond. They discover Doom, who jumps out the window, as Doom does. Reed explains that the drinks contained a hallucinogen which caused the team to see their close ones doing things that would intentionally rile them. Reunited, they head to Central Park, where Johnny and Ben are still fighting. Reed explains all, and the team is once again reunited. We'll take a break there. So, it's party time!
That doesn't sound like a trap, does it?
No! There is the comedy with the extra strong adhesive.
Yeah. I like that Sue wants to get all dressed up and Reed says, no, they want us to go in our funny tracksuit.
Actually, I've just noticed when Ben pulls the adhesive apart, it's still liquid. And then he drops it adhesive down onto the carpet.
It's stuck there forever.
Yes, constantly tripping over it. Oh, I suppose they've destroyed the backs of the building a few times. Once was nothing to do with villains. It was just, I'm fed up of tripping over this bloody thing. Activate the self-destruction sequence, Hobie. Herbie.
or Homie?
Hobie the Hope? No. No. No.
No.
No. No. Anyway, yes, embassies, scientific fellowships. Again, I'm going to refer to the expert in the educational field. A fellowship's not something that's awarded by educational institutes rather than buildings that officially belong to another country.
I'm going to go with yes.
Yes, I win. I win. Do my happy dance. I love the interior of the embassy.
To be fair, it could have been a grant. That would be close. That would be closer.
And Reed's always looking
like a government like, grant.
Yeah. Love that interior of the embassy. Such amazing detail.
I like the body language on the four as well. They all look a bit uncomfortable.
You remember when they went to Washington? Back
yes.
In, and they were made to stand there whilst other people ate.
Yeah.
This what they did in the 60s. We'd like to honour you by making you stand with no food or water whilst we eat and drink.
And just look at you.
Yeah. I mean, someone then comes around with a thermos flask full of a special drink.
Would you drink something that was pink?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Admittedly, Pepto-Bismol isn't very nice. That's pink. But, you know, lots of nice cocktails, which are very alcoholic and you don't notice they're in there.
That look kind of gloopy pink.
And Reed, again, demonstrating his odd ESP powers that I'm not sure we've ever seen before.
Yes.
It looks more like milkshake than a nice cocktail.
It's strawberry milkshake. Yeah, I drink a strawberry milkshake. It's my favourite one, especially from Byron's.
You drink a strawberry milkshake at this unusual embassy surrounded by these bizarre people who smoke.
Fine.
With those funny handles.
Okay, pink champagne.
Oh, all right, I'll have some of that.
Finally justified myself.
You'll just drink anything somebody puts in front of you then, won't you?
So long as it's not got Bacardi in. I do like the way this is set up. It's just there's opulence, there's the band and everything. Yeah, genuinely, this doesn't seem suspicious at all because they've got no reason at this time to connect Doom with Latveria.
No, that's very true.
That's true.
Oh, except that obviously the Dean knew that Doom came from Latveria.
Yeah, but the Dean has been taken care of a long time
ago. Is it me or does that drawing of Doom at the bottom of page 11?
He looks a bit off.
He looks sad. Sad Doom need hug.
Yeah, but I'm not giving him one. He smells of oil.
Yeah, it's that one's a little off.
Which is a shame, because the rest of this page is brilliant.
Mm.
Particularly the panel directly above that of the festivities beginning and the guy coming in with the harpsichord.
Yes, every dance needs a harpsichord.
I do like as well that Johnny gets suspicious of the drink as well, but drinks it anyway.
Drink, yeah.
This smells a bit odd. Oh, whatever. Yeah, necks it.
It tells you a little bit about his college life.
Yep.
Page 12.
The thing dancing with the elderly woman on the top page is brilliant. But what would Dory Evans make of Johnny hitting on the pretty girl in the pink dress?
Yeah.
Ben likes the big girls and Johnny likes the redheads. So.
Mm-hmm. All that needs to happen is Elisa needs to develop a bit of an overeating problem and they can... Yeah. Anyway, and then we've got this. I didn't really mention it in the recap, but the Ben that approaches Johnny is you can see through him.
Yeah, which was a great touch.
Yeah.
Because originally you're not sure whether it's an art mistake.
Mm. Yes, it is. It's confusing, which works very well. And then right at the bottom of the page, we finally get for the first time this episode a
flame on.
And it's a good little flame on as well. An unusual flame on.
Why is it unusual?
Well, it's the little bits of flame all over his body.
We've seen it before that they've chosen to depict him right at the moment of ignition rather than being fully flamed and, you know, flying out of a window into the sky.
I just like it. I think it's a lovely little artistic thing that we're seeing him at the beginning of the flame on instead of the usual he's ready and he's ready to fight. Yeah. I just like that one. I think it looks really good. Especially that his head's starting to steam as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I just thought it was a lovely little piece of art.
On page 12, Ben is busy chatting up the big lady.
Yep, and eating cake.
So what would Alicia think?
Oh, well, Alicia's not there, is she, sir? And she wouldn't see him, so.
Dear. Oh, dear.
I was only kidding.
What happens in Latveria stays in Latveria.
I've got this version of a superhero version of The Hangover now with the thing, Johnny and Tony Stark. And Steve Rogers is the stiff, straight one who doesn't want to drink anything and doesn't want to get in any trouble. And Tony's like, oh, live a little, Steve. And Thor's just sat there necking flagons of ale.
Steve ends up with a red skull tattoo in an awkward place.
I like that Ben is the one concerned about the fact they're fighting an embassy. This is an embassy, not a gym, he says, as he crashes through a wall. Oh, no, he's not. That's where he was. Johnny's already flown through the wall. But yeah, he's the one concerned about the amount of damage they'll do.
Yeah, this was the guy that destroyed an antique car at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, that worked out. No one was harmed. We've got Spectral Reed kissing a Spectral Lakvirian. And again, that is quite a shock to see. You know, yes, it is for Sue, but also for us, it's like, wow, wasn't expecting that. And for a moment, you don't even notice that he's see-through.
Yeah, the transparency is something you notice, you know, on second or third, you know, glance at it. It's very well done, cleverly done.
And we get a bit of a smackdown, four-way smackdown. The bit where Johnny flies into the pre-rolled carpet, it's a bit strange. At the bottom of page, what is that, page 14. Ben's already rolling up, so Johnny dives headfirst into it. Why didn't he say...
I think the thing is throwing it at him.
Yeah, it's
catches him in midair. Like
the thing has thrown it at him. I thought it slightly more dubious. He managed to wrap him up in a completely different body position to what he caught him.
Yeah.
And then he manages to carry him all the way downstairs to the front door and chuck him out the door.
And clearly it's not stated, but it has to be an asbestos carpet.
Oh, obviously, yes. Yeah. Although it can't be because he just burns it to shreds on the next panel.
All right. Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking, why didn't you just set fire to it immediately? I guess it took a while with the denseness of the material and obviously the underlay.
Underlay.
Arriba.
I like what Sue's doing to Reed in the next panel.
Yeah, attacking him with a speech balloon.
Which is great.
The depiction of her force field is basically, it looks like a speech balloon hurling into him, just with a dashed edge, except for instead of a solid one. And even the interior is white, as opposed to the rest of the panel is a beigey colour.
I don't know if they were doing thought balloons at the time. That's what you're whispering. She's just thinking this.
I love that Sue takes Reed out.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
He's trying to explain, and she just wails on him.
See, this is how you get to Sue, then. You obviously... Yeah. Picture in her head of Reed kissing another girl, and suddenly she becomes the ultimate fighting champion.
Yeah, Malice comes out 20 years too early.
Well, Reed did ask her to keep that costume.
But honey, don't you dare honey me.
That's a great line. She's crushing him behind a table.
And then the sequence on the next panel, Doom's about to have victory, so what he's going to do, I'm going to take off my mask and look at my face.
Yeah, I'm just going to pause here for a minute, and I'm just going to look at myself in a mirror that I'm then going to destroy.
How awesome is panel two, the random arm thing with the fire coming out of it? Just brilliant. It's like most people would have had a candle or a touch desk lamp. No, he's got some sort of subterranean lizard claw with fiery fingers.
Maybe wearing a metal face mask might not be the best way to improve your complexion.
But do notice panel four, what's he using to release his mask?
His funny little device that we never see again.
Yeah, I love his pose in panel six. Just very melodramatic. No, my face.
I like that he doesn't just smash the mirror. He blasts it to pieces.
With my gun.
Yes, because the suit of armor I'm wearing, it wouldn't do enough damage to the mirror.
And then we finally get two of the four facing off against Doom. And what does Doom do? He jumps out of a window. Oh, no, he doesn't jump. I got that wrong in the recap. I didn't notice that.
The force field pushes
Sue
him out.
Sue pushes him out with the force field. Damn it,
Sue
I got that
takes
wrong.
Him out. She is getting it done.
Yeah.
At this point, Doom doesn't know she can do all of this. Remember, her powers have expanded since he last met her.
No, they haven't. Fantastic Four 25 was the last time they met.
He still doesn't know she can do some of this, because that's a plot point later on.
Mm. No, he's experienced her fields before, because they've gone one-on-one, but he hasn't experienced her ability to turn other things invisible.
Think he would have been prepared for this, then?
Yeah, well, you know, he's still all sorts of emo. He's been taken by surprise.
Yeah, well, he's lucky he got his mask back on in time.
You can see him re-fix it in panel two of page 17.
Yeah, he's actually putting it back on, yeah.
Yeah, it's that classic thing where you walk in on the teenage boy and, yeah, maybe it isn't then.
At the bottom of page 17.
I was just going to say, you've missed the sexism.
Oh, God,
Reed,
yes.
Reed in full 1960s mode. Oh, Reed, I've been such a fool. Not a fool, Sue. Merely a female. As if those are different things.
You couldn't have reacted any differently. Yeah, that's really, That's awful, awful sex. That's possibly the worst we've had. Worse than keeping the men's morale up and things like that. It's like, no, you weren't a fool. You're a woman.
Stupid female.
Yeah.
Doesn't the imaginary Reed, who was making out with the Latverian courtesan, doesn't he seem like less of a douchebag than this actual real Reed?
Well, real Reed is a bit of a prick anyway. I mean, we could justify it by saying, oh, he's still annoyed that Sue, although she's rejected Namor, won't turn around and say, oh, no, but I'm all about you.
Mm-hmm. It's all Sue's fault, basically, I think is the moral of the story.
Yeah. And then it's off to Central Park where he spins Ben round like a top, which is a move I've never liked.
No, it's just a bit implausible, yeah. Isn't it?
It explains everything and everyone's best friends again. What? That's what happens.
No, it's not disagreeing with you.
So let's jump back into the final part of the recap. Returning to the Baxter building, the team discover that Doom has already arrived and is protected by a force shield. Reed sends Johnny into the sky with a conductor which channels the power of his Nova Blast into Doom's shield. The shield falls, but Doom's armor protects him. Reed then overstretches himself to save the spent Johnny who was falling to the earth. Ben tries to take Doom down, but Doom's armor contains a paralysis gun which fails him. Sue is next up, turning Doom invisible to confuse him and creating multiple shield pellets to unbalance him. Reed recovers and challenges Doom to a one-on-one mind fight. They drink, then use a machine to fight on the mental plane. Reed loses and is disintegrated, and Doom triumphantly exits. Except that Reed actually survived, and has spiked Doom's drink with the hallucinogen, using the machine to create a fiction in Doom's mind of his success. And thus, the issue ends with a smile. As I promised.
I don't have those last five panels. I think those may have been tacked on. Those might represent the apocryphal version of the story. And I think the story actually ends, as the title says, the final victory of Dr. Doom. I don't think Stan would have called it that if it turns out that it wasn't actually a victory. Hello?
Yeah, the final five panels are just propaganda from everyone else.
If you could do it, say, Brandon. You're on that final page. Can you just turn the page and see what's underneath? What's underneath that final page? What's on the next page? Clearly nothing. Well, it
nothing.
Must be true then. Although it's always talk of the final five. That's clearly only one of us gets that. Page. I can't even read that. Is that 19? Page 19.
Yes.
I'm too far away from my monitor. So back to the Baxter building. And I love the panel. I love the line work on panels 2 and 3, where they're in a dark corridor and there's the bright light from there. And you just look at Ben's platelets in panel 3 and that detail of the inking. We would probably have seen that before as just black splotches. Here it's properly fine line art.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the fight. I love the way the force field's portrayed, like the panel where Ben smashes it and you can see the field sort of absorb his punch but rolling with it as well.
I love the panel where he's punching Doom and the force field stopping it, but it's quite clear it's only just stopping him. He's very close to actually clunking him one.
Yeah, bending but not breaking.
The whole thing with Johnny taking the... I missed it. I've been looking for it. Sorry, page 19, panel 4.
It's clobbering time!
Yes.
It is.
It's a very subdued It's Clobbering Time.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, yes. Page 20. The whole sequence with Johnny flying up and channeling his Nova Blast down the conductor. It's fantastic. Really good. I mean, admittedly, panel 2 makes it look like he's flown about 5 miles out of the city, but...
That the sun going down in the west, it looks like it's been on quite a distance.
That's quite some curvature of the earth there.
I do like the shot of the Baxter building in panel 4.
Oh, yeah, nice perspective on that.
The top-down perspective.
Yeah, I like it whenever they all work as a team. Yeah, it's a really good example of them all working together now that we've got they all have to have a bit of a fight in every issue out of the way. But at least there was a plausible reason for them fighting this time.
Yes, it was Doom's manipulation rather than, we're 3 pages short.
Yeah, let's fight something.
I love Reed's exertion here to catch Johnny. That panel 4 on page 21, you can feel like the pain of him, the impact of him grabbing hold of Johnny and drawing hold of him. Also the fact that Johnny's still on fire. Yeah, it's great.
And that's a sort of detail that they don't always, you know, we sort of, you know, you guys have joked quite a bit how Johnny's, you know, Johnny's flame powers seem to burn things when they're needed and don't burn things when they're not needed.
Yes, you know, I burn them with the cold heat. What?
Yes. So the fact that he catches him and there's a consequence. I mean, it's a couple of panels, but they, you know, they made the effort to show the consequence of that.
But also they've sometimes used that catch-all thing of going, oh, well, I flamed off that part of my body so that person wouldn't get burned. It's like, that's not quite how it works.
Yeah.
Page 22.
I love Reed plunging his hands into the cell to stop them from burning.
Yes.
I thought it was a brilliant touch. And then, look, the second panel on this page is just awesome.
Yeah, Ben grabbing Doom by the lapels, a bit like Morecambe grabs Andre Previs.
I prefer the two panels that follow, which is Doom making it a right and taking down the thing.
Yeah, and he does, to be fair, he takes the thing down with his miniature paralysis gun that he happened to have with him at all times.
Of course.
Yeah, it's not like I've got a needle that... It's an actual gun in the palm of his hand, which must make it really annoying to do anything other than paralyze someone with. You know.
And then, again, at the bottom of this, you know, we got Sue. Mm. I'm not sure that... Has Sue shown the power to turn other people invisible, or maybe this is part of the illusion? But Sue, I mean, she's proving she's the most powerful member of the team, and I don't know if Stan just didn't realize the extent of her powers, or maybe Jack, or you know, whatever the process is. They're sort of slowly coming to realize, wow, invisibility and force bubbles. It's a pretty powerful thing.
It was when her powers evolved in, I think, issue 21, it was shown that she had the power to turn other things invisible there. But it's not been as widely used as the force fields. But it is great. And as a confusion tool, it's superb. I mean, once he gets used to it, yeah, it's probably not that helpful to have an invisible Doctor Doom running around. But as a way of throwing him, of putting him in a situation where he's dealing with something unexpected and unplanned, spot on.
Yeah, and again, that ties into the beginning of the story. That's what Doom was doing to them, throwing them into confusion.
Mm.
There's a nice little, you know, symmetry there.
And then we get the mind fight, and they have a drink beforehand.
Like, right, Doom. Do you think from that panel on the last page here, page 23... From that point on, it's all an illusion.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, no, I maybe from the third panel on page 24, because I think they definitely sit down at the thing. But because Doom's had a spiked drink, he's at a disadvantage.
There was some discussion about that as to where exactly the hallucination kicks in.
Mm.
And I kind of think it is from where they take the drink. So all of this next two pages are all in Doom's head.
See, I looked at it from the point where the colouring goes crazy.
The colouring goes pink.
It goes green in panels 4, 5 and 6 and then red in panels 7 and 8. But what's it doing in your book then?
It goes pink from panel 3.
I just think the person who scanned it is really crap at scanning.
He scanned it on the wrong resolution.
Yeah, he accidentally had an acetate filter. And there's some wonderful close-ups. That panel 6 where you got the close-up of Doom's eye through his mask.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing. And it is shocking to see Reed lose and be disintegrated. Although, why Reed built a machine that would disintegrate the loser? Built it in conjunction with... Oh, no, he didn't build it in conjunction with Doom. Doom just recognizes it.
That's why I'm actually willing to say that the hallucination begins at the drinking.
Okay.
It makes more sense to me. I mean, we're really weighing way deeper than Jack and Stan intended, probably. But it makes more sense for that machine to be a Doom creation than a Reed creation.
Okay.
And if that's the hallucination, that would be the type of victory he would hallucinate. Not just a victory, but a complete
annihilation,
dismantling of Reed.
And then you've got the creepy effect of Doom smiling. And he looks very happy and peaceful in panel 2 of page 25.
At the bottom of page 24, the happy dance that he's doing. That's a little disconcerting, even for those of us who are fans.
And then the story ends with them ready to fight him, or should he come back?
I like that they've just let him walk off.
Yeah.
Thinking that he's victorious, they just let him go. Are they not going to be like, you know, when he gets home and turns the TV on after he's made himself a mug of cocoa and he sees that the FF are still around and still alive, do they not think the first thing he's going to do is going to come and find them?
Yes. It does beg the question of how long Doom went without going, I'm just going to check what's going on there.
Because yeah, they don't even say, they do say it'll wear off someday. So Doom's living in this blissful ignorance now, is he? So essentially Reed's brainwashed him. The guy who has diplomatic immunity from another country.
Yes.
But he's the hero. He can do whatever he wants.
He's like Professor X mind-wiping people, isn't it?
Well, except Reed just mind-wiped Captain America. So that was in New Avengers, the Illuminati mind-wiped Captain America. Spoilers, by the way.
Never read it.
It's Hickman's New Avengers.
Oh, right.
And clearly the concept is that is, hey, I read Identity Crisis once. What did we think of this issue then? Or this story in this issue?
It was all right. It was a bit disappointing after the origin. It didn't feel like it deserved to be an annual story. It wasn't awful. By any means, I think Stan and Jack are now into the phase where they're not doing awful. But it just felt like it could have been an issue. There's only the origin at the beginning of it that makes this an annual. Because that was a pretty stellar story.
I did like sort of the action and the scope. I mean, at least it had the length, you know, of an epic. And even though there were a few pages in space, most of the action taking place in New York City, it still had that sort of the movement from the Baxter Building to the embassy to Central Park back to the Baxter. I like that sense of flow to it. And it does sort of give it an epic feel. It's a long story. It doesn't necessarily feel like a big story, though. And I think that may be what Andrew's getting at.
Yeah, I think the high watermark so far has been annual number one.
Yeah.
And I don't think they've beat that yet.
No, but rather sensibly, they didn't try and produce a sort of 60-page story. I can't remember how long the main story in annual number one was, but they didn't try and create a story of that length. We've got a reprint. We've got pinup pages. We've got a great origin story. And then we've got the latest Doctor Doom epic, which is, what, 2 or 3 pages longer than a normal Fantastic Four issue,
yeah.
Which allows for the art to do those nice big panels of like the Latverian embassy. But overall, I think it works really well as an annual. You've got the origin, which is the big draw, the first appearance of Doom, and then the latest match between the two of them. It'll be a little while before Doctor Doom returns. I can't think when it is.
I think 39 and 40 is the battle for the Baxter Building.
Yeah, that sounds about right. He might have an appearance.
I don't think he appears again before that.
Let's just quickly check that.
Yeah, the battle for the Baxter Building with Daredevil is 39 and 40. Yeah, I think that's, we don't get Doctor Doom before that.
No, you're absolutely right. Not even an appearance in anything else. So, yeah.
Well, of course not. He's defeated the Fantastic Four. It takes him 10 months to figure out. Whoops.
he's gone on holiday somewhere to Tibet.
So that's it for Doomy.
You wonder how they, how Stan and Jack with the Marvel method, you sort of wonder how much credit or in some cases blame, you know, to divvy up between the creators, you know, sort of classically their cases of, you know, Stan giving his artist, you know, one sentence or one paragraph, but so, you know, certainly the origin story and even this, you know, I mean, 25 page, you know, page story. You know, they had to have had more consultation, but you sort of wonder how much of that. I mean, obviously, Jack is in his element in really in both stories. You wonder how much of the pacing. You're just sort of curious how much of the pacing on these stories, how much of those choices, how much is Stan and how much is the artist just in, you know, in general. Because, you know, the artists, they aren't talking. I mean, it's been 50 years. The artists aren't talking. The only one who's talking is Stan. And to be honest, I don't always believe everything he says. When Stan is interviewed these days and when he's telling a story, I think the main his main intention is to tell a good story, you know, to the interviewer, not necessarily to give an accurate rendition of history.
That's almost exactly what Roy Thomas said when we were talking about it. And I kind of wish I'd prepared to actually speak to him a little more and actually sort of ask, you know, as someone who is there in the bullpen, you know, we talk about the Marvel method and, you know, how did that actually work? And obviously it was on a case-by-case basis, it was completely different. You know, Steve Ditko was basically doing everything in terms of storytelling, except Stan was going, oh, Sandman for this issue. And that was about it. Whereas I get the feeling that he's collaborating a lot closer with Jack And indeed, this is the point. This is long before they start having proper issues with each other, long before the communication does break down.
Right.
I think we have seen that the stories have, perhaps the plotting's been a little looser, but the plotting on the Origin especially was fantastic. It's really tight. Maybe the shorter length forced them to be really tight with that. But we then have, we're on the cusp of the real heights of the Fantastic Four. It's only a few right. episodes before we hit that major creative peak where they're so in sync.
We're getting close to some of those, you know, photo collage. I think he's sort of maybe teased that a little bit, but Jack is going to start to get pretty creative with what art can do in a comic book pretty soon.
Alan, thank you very, very much for joining us for this.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I knew from probably your second email, it's like, this guy likes Doom. We should have him on for the Doom episode. So it's just been fantastic. Do you want to take a couple of moments and just tell everybody out there in listener land where they can find you and listen to you and follow you and things like that?
Sure. I'm on Twitter as Professor Alan, and it's the English spelling, A-L-A-N. And I do a solo blog called Alan's Eyes and Ears, where I just write a couple times a week about books I'm reading, including comic books, podcasts I listen to, that sort of thing. That's at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com.
It must be a good blog because it gave us an award.
Exactly.
And now... Slightly nepotistic, because the person who beat us in that category was you.
Yes, but just think, next year, you'll be eligible for the best podcast I was on.
That is true.
Oh, think positive.
And in fact, I am certain that the Fantasticast was nominated for, and even won, a number of Eyes and Ears Awards over the years, before wrapping up the show in late 2019. Again, thanks to Andy for giving me the go-ahead to repost that audio. It really was a true pleasure to talk with him and Steve about this epic issue. And certainly, if your podcatcher is ever running short on shows to listen to, give the Fantasticast a try. Obviously, not every one of those episodes contains such a good story, covers such a classic issue, but the lads always did their best to make even stories that focused on, you know, the stretchy guy, entertaining as possible given that content. So we're going to have no feedback that we're going to go over this episode, but in addition to double feedback next time, we are not just going to the Savage Land, oh no, we are going to the Savage Land of 75 plus years into our future. And that Zaburific storyline cannot be contained to just one issue, or even just two issues. So in an episode that ought to be out sometime in September 2021, we'll be covering Doom 2099, issues 19, 20, and 21. If you have any comments on this episode, the Fantasticast, FF Annual 2, or anything related to the great and glorious leader of Latveria, feel free to contact me. That can be done via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment to the blog post or Facebook post for the episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening, and hail Doom!
Hail Doom!
Hail Doom!
Hail Doom!